You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello and welcome to the Hayek Program Podcast. I'm Stephanie Halfley, a senior fellow with the Hayek Program, and today I get the pleasure of conversing with Abby Hall about her research and her thoughts on writing in different mediums and talking to different audiences. Dr. Abigail R. Hall is an associate professor of economics at the University of Tampa. She received her PhD in economics from George Mason University and is an alum of our PhD fellowship program. Her research focuses on U.S. defense policy and militarism. She has published academic journal articles, books, and op-eds, and appeared on radio and television. Recently, Abby and her longstanding co-author, Chris Coyne, wrote a book of satire called How to Run Wars, a Confidential Playbook for the National Security Elite, published by the Independent Institute. We discuss the importance of their research in the increasingly militarized modern world and the role of satire in critiquing and resisting abuses of power. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Today, I'm joined with Dr. Abigail Hall. Thanks for coming on the Hayek Program Podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Abby is not only an accomplished economics professor, but a dear friend of mine. And so today I want to talk a bit about her research project, the different mediums and ways she communicates to different audiences, and how we think about disseminating and talking about the research that we think is important in impacting everyday life. So first off, Abby, tell us a little bit about your research project and how it's evolved over the past couple of years now with several books and articles and ways of thinking about these ideas.
Yeah, so when I first started working on issues related to defense and national security, very broadly speaking, I didn't really anticipate necessarily that I would still be working on it over a decade later, but am positively thrilled to still be working on this research program. And so that is really kind of how I would define the research program, is that I study defense policy very broadly construed, with an emphasis primarily on U.S. policy, some domestic policy, but primarily foreign policy. The program really started, or I started working within this program as a graduate student. So the first papers that I wrote while I was a graduate student were with a very dear friend and a co-author and a mentor, Chris Coyne. We started our work together looking at policing, and then that project kind of took us to another project and another project and another project. And then, as they say, the rest is history. So within that broad umbrella, we've done things like looking at surveillance, the implications of foreign intervention on domestic institutions. We've looked at the economics or the political economy of democratic propaganda. We've done some other work on policing. And then in addition to that, looking at linkages between, say, counterterrorism policy and immigration, I've done some work looking at domestic extremism within the United States. And now we're kind of pivoting a little bit, or I should say maybe expanding the research program to not only be looking at issues related to war, but also looking at foundations for peace, trying to understand transitions from states of war to states of peace. So for example, how do you get to a point in history where now you can't really think of Great Britain and France fighting with each other, where at one point they were considered to be bitter enemies, and the two of those countries going to war were just kind of a matter of course, and now you can't really conceive of it. So how do you get to those different types of transitions, and then how do those transitions really solidify? And so that's something that we've expanded into, and I imagine that that's hopefully, I'm optimistic, is going to be a fruitful avenue for us as well.
That's great. You know, I think, you know, we think about this idea of like peace and conflict studies, and it's often a feature. They often focus on conflict more than the element of peace. And so, you know, I think you're identifying a gap that seems to be really there. Maybe talk a little bit more about that of, you know, there is a ton of literature and people studying conflict and how it happens and how it's kind of inevitable and how we think about all those things. And we have some insights into peacefulness, right? If we can think about rule of law and trade and some of those things that economics does, but there does seem to be a area to really think through of understanding and seeing how peaceful relations can happen over time and hopefully how to sustain them.
Yes. And I think there really is a gap in the literature. So within the economics profession, there is a subfield of economics that's referred to as defense and peace economics. But I think as you've correctly pointed out, a lot of that is focused on the defense or the war aspect. So you see things about arms races, nuclear weapons, in more contemporary context, studies of things like terrorism and counterterrorism policy. But there's not definitely relatively little by comparison in studying peace and peaceful relationships. And I have a few different hypotheses as to why I think that's the case. But one of the things that makes this research program that I work in so unique is that I am an economist, but I don't typically deploy the types of methods that most economists feel particularly comfortable with. So even though some of my work has, say, kind of your standard regression models in it, most of my work employs different types of methodological approaches, namely analytical narratives, to take the economic way of thinking in places where those statistical tools are just inappropriate, or we don't have sufficient data to deploy those tools effectively. And I think with respect to the economics literature on peace, that that's also one of the big barriers is the inability to utilize the data tools that most economists are comfortable with to analyze those types of questions. And so I'm particularly optimistic about this kind of new vein that we're working on, because I think we have something meaningful to contribute, and there's not a lot of economic literature. Certainly there's literature within peace studies, and we have read and we've published in journals on peace studies, but I think that there's a whole lot more that economists can say.
So you mentioned that you are a bit surprised that you have stayed in this field, or you weren't necessarily certain that you would be focusing on this area for so long. Similarly, when I went into disaster studies and looking at how do communities recover after disaster, it started out kind of piecemeal, a paper here, a project here. And then you realize that it's a perpetual, like you're constantly having more questions, there's more things to study, and you start kind of, you know, following down that path. Could you maybe give us an example of how that's evolved for you over time, or how you've thought about how it's kind of, you know, you go down one avenue and then there's four or five more questions that you have after that, right? That kind of expands what you want to study next.
I have so many questions that I want to ask and answer that I know realistically that even if I had three lifetimes to research all the things that I wanted to research, I could never do it. And when I think back to when I started working within this research program, it was really just serendipitous if I think about it. Like, I was always interested in conflict and war. Just history has always been something that I found particularly interesting. And I always like watching and reading, you know, documentaries about different conflicts at different points in history. But when I entered into graduate school, I hadn't considered that as an area of focus. I actually came into graduate school thinking I wanted to study topics in labor economics, because that was what I'd had exposure to really as an undergraduate and had really enjoyed it. But when I was in, I think, this latter half of my first year of graduate school, Chris Coyne had approached me about working on an op-ed piece on policing and police militarization specifically. And then after working on that op-ed, he suggested or asked if I would be interested in working on a paper. And as a graduate student, I was new, but I wasn't dumb. And I knew a good offer when I heard one. And so we started working on that paper. But it's funny that you ask this question, because it was in the context of writing that paper that I actually got introduced to what would wind up being my dissertation research. And so within the process of researching policing and police militarization, I came across an article talking about how a particular unmanned aerial vehicle, or UAV, colloquially known as drones, that had been used in the war on terror were also being used almost simultaneously along the southern border of the United States. And I remember thinking that that was really interesting, but it wasn't appropriate for the paper that we were writing. And so I remember specifically taking that article and dragging it into a file folder on my computer, and then talking more with Chris later on about these issues related to UAVs or drones. And that then leading to, again, I wrote three papers on drones for my dissertation. So three different questions pursuing or related to UAVs. And then within that research, one of the papers that Chris and I wrote together was looking at the how it is that we wind up with this foreign technology, or this technology that's developed for the use in war abroad, how that comes back to be used domestically. And so that then got put into this broader framework that we developed in not only a paper, but then what would become the first book that we wrote together. And so all of the projects, or I should say, I think most of the projects that we've worked on together and that I've worked on individually or with some other co-authors, a lot of them relate to each other in that way, where you come across something that you think is really interesting, or you notice some kind of a connective thread, or you're thinking about something that makes you think of something else. And so it's been a very like natural, organic evolution of going from topic to topic, or finding these different intersections. And so some of it has been you see something immediately and you think, ooh, I know what I want to write about on this particular topic. But others are things that you just read and you think, oh, that's really interesting. I'm not sure what I want to do with that yet. And then you think on it for a while, or you put it in a file on the computer. And then a year or two later, something else will remind you of it. And then you call it out again.
I think that highlights something really interesting about, you know, what does a robust research program look like for an academic? And so for me, I think, and it seems like this is for you, you're pulling these threads and there's new questions and things that are coming up every time, right? But also this understanding of there's all these things we don't know yet, because it's a process of learning about, you know, learning more and digging into different layers and different complexities. And often you're put in a, like in discussions or in class or in other places where there's this kind of common idea that an expert is all knowing, right? And that you kind of know everything that you have, and you can, you know, like a book encompasses all the different ways that you can think about that idea, and that it's kind of like compact and done. Or sometimes you have students, right, who are nervous to go from reading to writing as they kind of dig into that space. And so, you know, I think being able to talk about and kind of see, hopefully, that process of understanding as an ever evolving one, but how do we combat that with this sort of common idea of needing to be an expert, needing to know the answers, kind of how that, you know, we see that in media and news and politics and all of these things, right? Like, an ethos of understanding and inquiry seems to be, you know, potentially something that we should be able to talk about kind of outside of those individual processes. What do you think about that? And do you think that there's, you know, kind of things that we should tease out, or ways we can teach people about those things?
So there's a lot of things about that specifically. So one of my favorite things about being an academic is that I constantly get to learn new things. And so I am under absolutely no illusion that I know everything there is to know, even about topics with which I feel very confident and comfortable. But there's always something that I don't know, or a new perspective that I could get, some new data, some new information, some new framework. And so I try to be very aware and open to looking at and reading and talking to people who may have a different perspective or who might look at something differently than the way I do. When it comes to thinking about research, and this is something that I've experienced a lot with graduate students. So at the University of Tampa, I teach in our Doctor of Business Administration program. And I get those students typically at the very end of their coursework, right before they're about to propose their dissertations. And one of the things that has come up with those students, but it has also been true with the other graduate students that I've worked with specifically, is that there's this tendency to think just that, that you have to have all of the answers, you have to know exactly what you're doing, and you have to create some like grand unified theory of some topic. Or you want one paper to be able to answer these like four different questions with these four different frameworks. And it's kind of a gross metaphor, but I think that it works. I tell people, if you think about the face of academic literature, that any paper is like a singular pimple on the face of that literature, where it's relatively small, but even though it's small, it can be quite painful in terms of its production processes, and it might be very noticeable depending on what exactly that pimple looks like. And so when I phrase it like that, people usually have some mixture of they think it's quirky and also maybe kind of gross, but it gets the point across. It's like your job is to be a single pimple, not full-blown acne. Like, you can't do everything in one paper. You can't do everything in one book. Even if you're writing a 1,000-page tome, you can't do anything in one, you can't do everything in one particular project. And so when you approach, or at least when I think about my own approach to my work, I think about it as a, how is this adding to my own body of knowledge, but then also potentially adding into other people's knowledge? Not thinking for a second that I've cracked the code for absolutely everything or that I've said the final word on the subject. I really, and I would hope that no one would interpret my work that way, that it's the final word on the subject. And so I think, but that's not always, I think, an easy approach to adopt, especially when you're just starting out or when you're building a research program and you really want it to be something that is big and meaningful and impactful, but it really is something that you lay brick by brick.
When I think about sort of, you know, like there's social pressure, there's things about, you know, showing that you have the knowledge to be in the conversation that I think can often add some pressure and anxiety to students as we kind of think through that. And, you know, I think both of us probably have stories of that for when we were students as well. You know, I think there's something at that, right? Of how innate does that come to you? Which way? You know, kind of think about it in this kind of curious open space, or to be really nervous or concerned or need to, you have more of a final say. And I kind of think about, you know, as a child, I was a really curious kid and I asked a lot of questions. And you were saying, I have so many questions I'll never get to, right? When you were talking about your research project. And sometimes that can be encouraged. And sometimes that's like, you're asking too many questions, please stop, sort of idea. And I think, you know, having both gotten our graduate degrees at George Mason with the economics faculty that are there and you know, I think that's a space where it encourages the questions a little bit more. You know, going into your PhD, you didn't know that this was the area that you were going to go into, and you weren't quite sure. You know, do you think that you kind of had that curiosity and maybe like intellectual humility of it's all an iterative process going in? Was it emphasized as you were going? Kind of how have you learned that and embraced that over time?
I think it was probably a bit of both, where I've always been really curious. So prior to graduate school, I was always reading something. And even now, I'm constantly reading books on different things. And sometimes they show up in my work in ways that I didn't anticipate. I'll give you an example. I was reading a book about the former, like, CEO of United Fruit, a man by the name of Samuel Zamuri, who there's clear linkages with foreign policy, and that United Fruit, if people are not aware, was instrumental in overthrowing several Latin American governments. And so it related in that way, but that wasn't why I was reading the book. But I've used that specific example several times in my work, and it just kind of happened to show up from stuff that I was reading for pleasure. But in terms of the openness, I think I've always been curious about different things, and I've always liked knowledge for the sake of knowledge and learning for the sake of learning. So there was definitely that innate curiosity. But I was certainly in my graduate program encouraged to think critically about a lot of topics, to write really liberally about different topics as a means of practice, and also trying to figure out what my own comparative advantage was in. But the other thing that I really appreciated about my graduate training was that I was pushed to participate and to speak and to articulate my thoughts when I wasn't confident in them. And it was okay to be wrong. And so there was not a, I mean, it never feels good to put an opinion on the table and then somebody says something in response where you realize that what you said maybe was not the most profound thing that you've ever said. But that permission and encouragement to try and to be present and participate is something that, even though it might not have been the most comfortable at the time, I am incredibly grateful for, because I am not afraid to think through something and to think through something out loud. And it's definitely something that I've carried into my own research, but is also something that I've carried into my classroom, where I really make an effort to encourage students to think through complicated problems, to articulate what it is that they're thinking. And it's not uncommon for me to say in class to my students, I'm like, somebody give me your best shot. The worst thing that you can be is wrong. And it's really low stakes right now for you to be wrong, but it's really beneficial to think through and to articulate your own thoughts. And so that, I think both of those things have been really integral, but definitely the space and the training that I had as a graduate student was fundamental.
And I can think about that in being able to kind of think through ideas as they come out, change your mind, or be convinced of another way to look at it, and how to talk about that seems to be really important in kind of all aspects of life. As you were talking, I was thinking about how not only is it the fact that as a student or as you're learning, being able to give it a shot and articulate what you get and learn from that, but what that means as the professor on that side as well, right? And I think in an environment like that, you likely see things from a new perspective, or maybe think about something in a different way than you have before because of what your students are doing, or potentially done research that you weren't expecting to do as well. And so, you know, as we kind of think about the research project and how that kind of grew with Chris and how it's expanded off and kind of doing those things, do you have any examples of, you know, kind of students helping find that next branch that goes along in the research path as well?
So I've been very fortunate to work with a variety of different graduate students. So both graduate students at George Mason, as well as some undergraduate students at the University of Tampa and a few other folks elsewhere. And I would say some obvious linkages would be some of the work that I've done related to immigration policy specifically, which I've done work with Nathan Goodman and Carla Segovia. We've done a couple papers at this point on El Salvador, which is related to the overarching research program that I write in, but is definitely a different branch. In terms of undergraduate students at the University of Tampa, I've published with three of them. One, again, was related to immigration, so asylum policy, which connects broadly to counterterrorism policy. But the one that sticks out most saliently in my mind, and this is, I think, a good example of how you can get inspired by random things, but then also your students can help you figure out puzzles too, is I wrote a paper with, again, now an alumni of the university and a co-author, and I
consider him now to be a delightful friend, Jaron Hassell. And we wrote a paper together on domestic extremism in the United States, specifically highlighting how the tools of foreign intervention come to be adopted by domestic extremist groups. And that idea came after Chris and I had published our first book in 2018, Tyranny Comes Home. But I was listening to a podcast, and the podcaster in a single line mentioned how there was an influx of Vietnam veterans into the Ku Klux Klan after Vietnam. And I remember saying, huh, I didn't know that, and I'm really interested in that. So Jared, a student at the time, had expressed an interest in research. And so I explained it to him, and I said, I don't really know like what this is going to turn into, but how would you feel about working on it? And in the process of working through that paper with him, I thought we were going to be discussing probably the KKK. And instead, we wound up discussing a few different extremist groups based on things that he had found and information that he knew. He has a military background. And so he was able to look and recognize things that which I frankly would not have seen. And so that is a really clear example in my mind, but even like a very recent one, I just finished teaching a May-term course on the economics of repugnant markets. And I run that course like a seminar where I have a component that's lecture, but then the students are responsible for going out, researching a topic that's related to the overall theme of the day, and then coming back after several hours and presenting what it is that they've found. And I'm always delightfully surprised by how some students think about questions in just creative and novel ways. So I came away from this class, we just finished yesterday, and I came away from this class with just really impressed by how some of them thought about things. And it's given me a few different things to think about with respect to a couple of these topics, which again, I teach them. But it's a nice reminder that there's always a different way to think about something. And I appreciate how much they teach me.
That's great. You know, kind of that the openness to the research project and the question, I think also shines through in the openness that you have tackled with communicating these ideas as you learn them through different mediums and to different audiences. So of course, as an academic, you have academic journal articles and books from major academic publishers, but you have also done op-eds and media, and one of your most recent books is a satire on these ideas. And so I'd love to just kind of hear how you think about which audiences you want to talk to and when and how. And this exploration in multiple ways of communicating these ideas, and kind of what you think about that as, you know, you can obviously as an academic just talk to academics, or you can have this broader conversation. And so, yeah, what do you think about that?
So I've always enjoyed working with media partners, so television, radio, podcasting, et cetera. There's, you know, a billion different forms of media now, except for Twitter. I can't. that's the one where it's like, please don't ask me to make a TikTok. Though for some people, I probably would. It's like, please don't ask me to make a TikTok. And I am not committed enough to do Twitter or X to make that worthwhile. But I make it a point to try to be available for media and media partners. So whether that's local, national, or international. And the reason for that is very purposeful. So as you mentioned, as academics, we're really well trained to talk to other academics. And for those of us who are at institutions that have some kind of emphasis on teaching, we're expected to know how to communicate the ideas of our discipline to students. But this leaves out a massive chunk of the population. And so from my own perspective, if I think that economics has something to offer to people outside of academia and a university college student, then doing media is a way to offer these ideas to broader audiences. And so I've really worked not only to develop my own skill set in terms of talking to media, but also trying to develop relationships with media partners. So as you mentioned, that's consisted of a lot of op-ed writing. It's consisted of doing some, you know, radio, television spots. And I find those things to be rewarding because it can really help, I think, get ideas out to people who might not usually encounter them. And it also, frankly, has made me a better communicator of economic ideas. It's one thing to have 90 minutes in a lecture period where you can convey a broad idea and give your students a graph and show them a lot of different examples and try to make sure they understand. It's something very different to go into a segment and saying, okay, within 4 minutes, you need to communicate the key things that the audience needs to know, keeping in mind that if they don't find you somewhat engaging, they're just going to change the channel or they're going to tune you out. And so that's been one area. You mentioned talking to other groups, and that also has been something that I've been fortunate enough to be able to do. A lot of people have invited me to come speak on my work. Sometimes that's to, you know, wider community audiences. Sometimes it's at conferences or to groups of students or groups of faculty or mixtures of different kinds of people. And I've enjoyed those too. I've gotten more comfortable saying yes to maybe some things that I would have said no to or would have maybe been anxious about doing in the past, because I'm trying deliberately, just this is a kind of a personal goal, to push or expand the areas in which I'm comfortable speaking to different groups. And for those different groups, you'd asked about, you know, how do I go about thinking about it? I think about what the group is and what they're interested in and what are the things that I think they would find most informative, but maybe what are the things that I think they need to know. Sometimes they might not like those things that I think that they need to know, but that's how I go into thinking about those different types of conversations. And then in terms of medium, so you mentioned the satire book, which is our most recent collaboration, Chris and I together in book form. And that full credit to my co-author who came to me and said, hey, here's this book that was written in the 1930s. It's a satire. Have you heard of it? I said, no. He says, you should read it and let me know what you think. And I read it and I loved it. And he said, well, how would you feel about updating it? And I mean, I couldn't get the word yes out of my mouth fast enough. And I owe Chris a lot of credit for the willingness and ability, I think, to play around with different types of formats, because he has always been very encouraging and very open to speaking to other disciplines. So we've published together in law journals and in peace studies journals. Not he and I together, but I then felt really comfortable when, say, like my colleagues in criminology wanted to work on a couple projects. And so I'd had some practice in speaking to different groups. So then trying things like satire or trying other types of means of communication are not as intimidating, but with like the satire specifically, that is intended to reach a different audience than maybe the people who are typically picking up the books that we write. And so it's an experiment, but it's been one of my favorite things to write.
That's great. You know, I think, you know, after you get comfortable writing a research paper, the next one can kind of feel similar, but we can always go back into that. If we're going back to the pimple example, it can get painful when you don't, even if you don't expect it. Kind of similarly branching out into different mediums, right? Like the you know, kind of fully grasping what it takes to write a book the first time, fully kind of getting to understand, like sometimes writing an op-ed is harder than writing some of those things because it has to be so specific and short, and you can't provide context. You know, kind of what have you learned in that process and how have you kind of reminded yourself to stay open in those spaces because it is kind of different every time?
Well, so you mentioned op-eds specifically, and I assign op-eds to my students sometimes, especially if I have a group that likes to be really wordy, because if you are writing an op-ed, 750 words is pretty much your upper bound for publication. Now, there are some exceptions to that rule, but that's a good rule of thumb. And it is exceptionally difficult
to convey a complete cohesive argument in 750 words. It can be done, but you have to be very, very judicious in what you say and how you say it. In a similar type of way, you mentioned going from writing a paper to writing an academic book. Those are also two really different exercises. And then writing a purely academic book and then switching and writing satire was completely different. And then folks want to know what we're working on right now, we're working on an intellectual biography of economic historian Robert Higgs. And working on an intellectual biography where we're doing a lot of interviewing and talking to the person we're writing the book about, that's also been a very different experience. And even though we've not started working on that book yet, I know that writing that is also going to be something that's going to push me in a way that I've not probably been pushed before. So I think all of these different writing experiences together, they've generally honed my skills, I think, as a writer and communicator more generally. But in terms of openness, I'd like to think that it's made me particularly good at taking critique. Because one of the things that happens when you have to write in different styles or when you're writing for different audiences or different people is that what's appropriate or what's most effective is different for those different groups. And so you have to not only learn how to hone your own skills, but to also be willing to accept feedback from people who might know that medium better than you do. So there is an editor who I work with some regularity on some of my op-ed pieces. And I'm at the point now where when I submit the piece, I'll ask to have him review it specifically. And I'll usually say something like, because he always makes me better. And so thinking about or taking that kind of critique, and not just from that editor, but then when you get comments back from, say, like referees on a book, or you get comments back from an editor of a journal, approaching those as opportunities to think deeply about your own work product and then to try to incorporate the valuable components of that feedback is something that's been really helpful. It keeps you from, I think, again, what we were talking about earlier, it puts you in your place in terms of reminding you that you still have things to learn. And so I've appreciated that about working in different types of medium and the feedback that I get. It's helpful for me in a number of ways.
It's great. I was immediately thinking about that as well of, you know, if there is this sort of idea that you need to be the expert and have all the knowledge, right? Then it can be really hard to accept criticism or kind of be open in that space. And so, you know, if we're really thinking about how do we understand the world and maybe have things to say about where it could be better or where we should rethink ideas, being able to, one, have the intellectual humility to say, I don't know everything, and the openness to learn in different ways seems really important. And, you know, we can look around the world today and see that there are areas of life where that is not encouraged, right? I remember when I was a graduate student and I was helping with testimony on the Hill, and we go and I'm seeing the scholar I'm working with give testimony on the Hill, and another person on the panel is asked a question and they're like, I don't know the answer. And the response from the politicians was like, oh, well, then everything you say is invalid, or you're a coward, or you're doing those things, right? And to see that was like, oh, this is like, to go into this world requires something else. But what if we were in a space where we could learn and discuss and kind of talk about those ideas?
Yeah. And it's one of the things that I like to tie things back to teaching, because it's one of the things that I do most often, and it's something that I'm really passionate about. But I tell my students when they ask me a question and I don't know, I tell them I don't know. Or it's like, you know, I've never really thought about that question before. Let me think about it and then I will get back to you, or say like, that's a really good question. I want to give it the answer it deserves, and I can't do that right now. And I think that that's important, not just for me, but it's also important for them to see that they don't have to have all of the answers right away. But I'll tell you, oddly enough, the thing that has actually made me more comfortable saying, I don't know, ironically, perhaps, is working with media, because you can get some really just far out questions from a reporter from time to time, or like, God forbid, you're on a show where people from the public are calling in and you really don't know what people are going to ask you. But you, the reality is you can't be an expert on everything. And so sometimes being able to say to someone, if they ask you a question, and to be able to say, no, that's not something that I am an expert in, or saying, especially too, when you're talking about like recent policy changes and people are asking you questions about like, well, how will this impact A, B, or C? And saying things like, well, you know, we don't know that information yet, or it's too early to tell the precise effects, but what economics teaches us is this, or we might see this go in one of two ways. This is one option. This is another type of option. And so not only getting more comfortable with feeling like I don't have to have an answer to every question, but articulating that I don't have an answer to every question, but articulating that ignorance or that lack of knowledge with an awareness. And I think that that also is important. It's something different to, because people aren't just totally adrift when you're selling them something and you don't know what you're talking about. And so being, I think, honest like that in a way is sometimes refreshing to people, again, depending upon the group. But I don't ever say things that I don't feel comfortable saying. I don't say things that I think are untrue. I try very hard to not just pull stuff out of thin air, or if I do, I will usually preface it by saying, this is not something I've thought out really carefully, but these are my initial impressions. And that is it. It seems very counterintuitive, because most of the time when you see people doing any type of media, they're coming across as very authoritative and they are the expert in absolutely everything. But I think people appreciate the ability of people to say, you know, this is really outside of the scope of what I've researched, but here's what I can tell you.
I think that sort of modeling responsible expertise maybe is the way to think about it. And so, you know, if the tendency is to kind of try to always have an answer or the right answer, and we don't, right? There's a lot of pressure on that. And so to model that also shows ways that other people can maybe do that in other aspects of their life as well.
Well, and also pointing them to people who know things better than I do. So I've had an occasion to do actually quite a bit of consulting for media. And a lot of that has been related to the market for illegal drugs. And the other part has been, I've consulted on several different media projects looking at policing and police militarization specifically. And I feel very comfortable talking about U.S. domestic police and the militarization of U.S. domestic police. But that's not the only place that police have militarized. And so sometimes within those conversations, people have asked me about militarization in the European Union or in Latin America specifically. And those are not my areas of expertise. I know the general trends, but I am not intimately familiar with those details. But I know people who are. And so and again, it's hard because you want to be able to answer people's questions. But I've gotten, I think, comfortable with saying, you know, that's not, again, my area of expertise, but I know someone who could probably answer that question. Would you like me to connect you with them? And that, I think, is, again, intellectually honest, but it also is really collaborative and relationship building, because then the media partners will come back to you, but then the people who you refer folks to will also remember that you referred people to them and then oftentimes give you the same courtesy, which is not why I'm doing it, but it is definitely a nice spillover, I think. And it's a way to broaden and kind of maintain networks in a way which people might not think about.
No, I think that's great to think about it in that way and to really kind of, you know, I think a lot of what we talked about today is sort of the process of studying and understanding and communicating these ideas. And it does kind of come back to sort of an openness and curiosity, right? And a, you know, kind of willingness to know that it's an ongoing project. And that can mean that you, it's an ongoing project for you, but also for other people too, and that you can bring in ideas from other people and, you know, learn from or collaborate with new people as you kind of go along. And so I would say like that in many ways, when I was first excited about ideas in high school and college and thinking about I wanted to go into that space, right, is sort of like what you hope it will be. And then life can be complicated and confusing. But I think, you know, I think you're modeling a great way to do that. And then kind of hopefully that also shows other people how to think about these ideas and that you don't necessarily have to be set in stone. You can change your mind over time.
And I think that's absolutely right. I don't ever want to feel like I'm done with my research program. I don't ever want to feel like that I have come to a meaningful, you know, quote unquote, conclusion. There's so much out there that I don't know, and so many things that I want to know and I want to understand and I'm really curious about. And as you mentioned, that really does open up the door to work with not only a lot of other people. So I've had the tremendous opportunity to benefit from working with different people in multiple different fields and also different, say, people even within my own field of economics, again, different levels of training. So graduate students, freshly minted PhDs, people who are as established as I am, and then people who've been around the block quite a few more times than I have. And all of these people bring different things to the table, and you can learn so much from them. And I really do just relish the opportunity to learn. And it's one of actually my favorite things about academia is it's like, I get to nerd out about whatever thing I want to nerd out about. And there's so much that, like, if my 10-year-old self knew that I was going to get to do that for, you know, a career, I mean, it's the best. Like, it's absolutely the best. But I hope that if nothing else, this method of inquiry has been effective for me. And to the extent that it's helpful for other people, so if it's for my own undergraduate or graduate students, or if it's for the graduate students who I've worked with in other capacities, then I hope it's really helpful for them. It certainly makes it a lot more pleasurable. It certainly makes it a lot more fun. And the other thing it does too is it lets you communicate with different kinds of people. And so I can go into a room, or I can go to, say, a party with my husband who's not in academia, and I can carry on a conversation with people who have really different backgrounds. And when they ask me, well, what do you work on? I have the tools to be able to explain it in a way that I hope isn't going to put them into a coma from boredom.
That's great. Well, are you reading anything interesting or learned or changed your mind on a fact that we can maybe end with?
Well, so I am currently reading, I've gotten recently on a World War I, World War II kick, but I realized that I didn't really know much about the Eastern Front. So that's what I've been reading mostly. I finished a book called Stalin, which is a pretty lengthy book on, well, kind of what it sounds like, but it's quite comprehensive. And then I just recently started a book called Bloodlands, which is about the, you know, Eastern Front. So particularly like the dynamics between Germany and Russia and say like Poland and Ukraine. And in terms of something that I have changed an opinion on, it would actually probably surprise most people to know that if you would have talked to me when I was in college, I would have not been particularly anti-war. In fact, I was probably Not probably. I don't think that I had any really issues whatsoever with the war in Iraq at first. Now, then again, like, you know, 2003, I was still not particularly well-developed in terms of my, you know, political and economic consciousness. But my views on war and conflict have shifted dramatically from when I was, say, in high school or early in college to where they are now. And so in that sense, it's been not just something I've changed my mind on. The entire outlook is completely different than what it was before.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today about this. And hopefully people will get something out of it and be inspired to maybe go ask some new questions as we think about what's next.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.